Hello, I'm Katie Piper, and welcome to my podcast, Katie Piper's Extraordinary People. Each episode, I'll meet an amazing person with an incredible story who faced adversity and came through the other side to inspire others. Today, I'm talking to Katie G, a campaigner and survivor who's truly amazing. I first met her through my charity 6 years ago, and we have more in common than just being called Katie, because she is also the survivor of an acid attack. She's still so young, and she talks with incredible openness about her experience and how she feels now and looking forward. Now, you are a survivor, a campaigner, and also a trainee in property currently.
Yes.
I'm going to let you take the floor and talk about how we met and why.
Okay. The first time we met, I was in hospital, I think, at this point for maybe a few weeks. I actually can't remember. Overall, it was 2 months in total, so I don't know at what point you came. Yeah. I think you came to hospital twice.
Yeah, I can't remember either.
I think you came twice because the second time, I remember you saying the first time you didn't really speak, but now you're speaking more.
Yeah. I think the first time I met you, you had all your dressings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
I was in Chelsea and Westminster Hospital too, obviously not the same time as you, years before you. So another thing we have in common, and also what we have in common, is we were in that very same hospital for the exact same reason.
Yeah.
You were a victim of an acid attack as well.
Yes, exactly.
But it didn't happen in the UK, right?
No. So I was travelling. I was meant to start university in the September. And so the summer before, I wanted to go travelling somewhere new with a friend. So myself and my friend Kirsty went over to Zanzibar, which is an island just off of Tanzania in Africa.
What made you choose Zanzibar?
We travelled with a company, and that was one of the destinations that was on their website, and we wanted to go somewhere we'd never been before.
Had you travelled before then?
Yeah, but never to Africa.
Yeah.
And so we chose Zanzibar. We went for about a month. We were teaching kids volunteering.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And we were teaching them English and maths. And then it was the last weekend on the island where two guys on a moped just came from my right-hand side and then threw the acid and then drove off straight away.
Wow. So there it is in one sentence, but it's a life-changing thing that happened to you.
Yes.
And you were really young. You were 18, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was 18.
At a time when most people, I mean, what are they doing? They're 18. They're like
about to start uni, like going crazy, having fun.
Getting drunk, like making some life-changing decisions, but nothing like the situation.
No, exactly. Just finished our A-levels, so having fun.
Mm. Now, that trip, I mean, up until that point, had everything been fairly normal in that trip?
Yeah, more or less. We were just really enjoying it, learning, experiencing the culture, travelling around Zanzibar to the mainland.
And now you look back, like, you know, with hindsight, you kind of look at things differently. Do you think there was anything weird up until that point? Is there anything you second-guessed or like, you were like, this isn't right, or I get a bad feeling about something or anybody?
Before we went, we were warned just to be careful in terms of there have been a few muggings on the island, or they might see us as white, which means they might assume that maybe we have some money or travelling around the island. So in terms of safety in that way, we were told to just be careful. But we never really felt too much at danger. There were a few times where maybe we felt a bit uneasy. But if we were walking back late at night to the volunteer house, anywhere, you might feel a bit uneasy. So there was nothing that really stood out. There were like a few occasions maybe, but nothing that warranted any type of argument, attack, anything along those lines.
And that's quite a normal, when you travel to certain parts of the world, different continents, like people tell you those kind of warnings anyway, don't
even
they?
In Europe, anywhere
in
you might. Yeah, in London, yeah.
Yeah, so,
exactly.
So nothing strange. So like, obviously I know myself, like this kind of attack is like so quick.
Yeah.
There's no kind of predicting it or, you know. Did you know what had happened to you?
I did. And I don't know how I knew, but within seconds, I was like, I thought to myself, okay, this is definitely acid. Like, not that I'd ever knew what it would have felt like, but you just know your instincts kick in. And like, I looked at Kirsty straight away and I saw that she like kind of looked okay. So the first thing I did was wipe my eyes with my jumper. And tried to read the number plate and then ran straight to the bathroom. But I just knew straight away. Did you know straight away?
Yeah.
You just know, because you're not stupid, you just know.
Yeah. And what an amazing
survival instinct, you looked at the number plate. Like, despite being, like, blinded, you still had that thought in your head to look at the number plate.
I know, it's a bit crazy.
Yeah. Did you remember it?
I remembered, like, one letter. I think it had an R and an X in it. But they drove away so fast. And I dropped my phone and my purse, and I remember, like, picking up thinking, I'm going to need this.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like you just go into complete survival mode when something like that happens.
And was Kirsty... was it so severe that Kirsty couldn't help you, or was she able to help you because it wasn't as...
We had completely different reactions. I very much had like a rational, like, this has happened, mm-hmm. this hurts, I need to get water, get my phone in case I need to call someone, because Kirsty didn't have a phone.
Yeah.
Kirsty, I remember, was sitting on the floor and like screaming, and we were both screaming, obviously, but we just had completely different reactions.
Yeah. Where were you on the roadside?
Yeah, so we were on the outskirts of Stone Town, and the road was on our right-hand side. It was a very thin road. I don't know if a car could fit down it, but it was definitely a road.
Was it daylight or dark?
Sunset. So it was the last day of Ramadan.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why the streets are quite quiet. Everyone's inside praying. So the sun was about to go down.
And had the people on the bike, did they cover their appearance, or could you see?
No, we saw them.
Do you still remember their faces now?
I like to think I remember the guy on the back's face. But who knows? I've probably like pictured him so many times in my head that I've changed what he looks like.
Yeah.
I would like to think I would remember, but I mean, I have no idea.
Yeah. Okay. So how did you, from that moment of the attack and being down that narrow road, how did you get to some kind of aid or help?
So there was a restaurant about 2 minutes down the road that we had eaten at a few times. And I knew where we were. Obviously, we had been there for a month. So I ran straight to the bathroom of that restaurant. And because we were next to the sea, it was kind of like one of those bathroom showers where there's showers in a bathroom. So I remember I just ran in, turned on every single tap in panic.
Yeah.
And then I like got completely undressed. And then I just started screaming for help.
Yeah.
And then I was like washing myself with tap water, and it was coming out really slowly. So I would walk to the showers, get all the water, and then walk over to the tap, and and then screaming in between.
And what about the pain level at this point?
It was excruciating. I remember for the first like 5 seconds, it didn't really feel like a burning pain.
Mm.
And then it comes in a rush. That's what I had anyway. It just started building up more and more. So for the first few seconds, it felt like hot coffee or something. And then it just gets more intense. And that's when you know, okay, this isn't.
And like visually, like for the public, when you see that, it sounds weird. You just look like a crazy person screaming, because it doesn't look like when someone's on fire.
Yeah, exactly. It's really an underwhelming look at first.
Yeah. So like you're naked in a Muslim country screaming.
Yeah.
Like people might just think you're drunk or, you know, how did they react? Like,
So because I was in the bathroom, I remember screaming for help, and then two tourists, one called Sam, one called Nadine, thought at first that I was like messing around, or it was like kids having fun, whatever.
Yeah.
And then as the screaming like continued, and Sam heard me say someone needs to help me, then he came and he saw me, and he thought I was raped, because at first you don't really see anything. Yeah, your skin is a bit discolored, but he thought that this girl's been raped in this bathroom. And then he had lots of bottled water on him, and he was helping me, and then screamed at other people to go get more water, and from there. Did you think it was acid straight away?
For the very first instant, I thought the person had thrown a cup of petrol and flicked a match, and I could feel so much heat, so I thought I was on fire. And then after my eyesight started to go, I knew exactly what it was. Yeah. So it's all like in like little, like it feels like ages, but it's little seconds, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah,
I feel like you are in slow motion a bit. You just remember each sequence of what happens.
Yeah. So from that shower, did you get taken to a local hospital?
We did. We got in a cab about 5 minute journey away and went to a local hospital with Sam, Nadine, the two tourists who helped me. And
like just getting in a cab like that though, not even in an ambulance, like you must have been in agony.
I remember I was sitting in the back next to the window. Kirsty was in the middle and Sam and Nadine were in the front, and Nadine was in the back. And I remember Kirsty being like, oh no, what's happened? And I couldn't even speak at this point. No. I remember my head was leaning against like the front seat, and I just remember thinking like, I actually can't even respond right now. You're just in so much pain, and I didn't think it was ever going to go. And
you've had no morphine.
Yeah,
nothing,
and like not even enough water probably. And I didn't know what was happening. Kirsty didn't have a phone, and it was just horrible.
So what treatment did you receive when you got to that hospital? Did you get put in intensive care? Or
at that point, we were just covering ourselves with saline and more water. And Sam, at this point, had taken my phone and called our parents and our friends who we had on the island.
What a call for a mum to get.
I know. And I'd spoken to my mum about 10 minutes before the attack, asking her for more money for dinner because I
classic
ran out of money as a traveller.
Yeah.
And so I remember Sam said that when he called my mum and my mum was answered the phone and she said, Katie, I just gave you more money. And he was like, no, my name's Sam. And then explained what happened. And
what did he say? Your daughter's...
Yeah, he was like, don't worry, but something's happened. Like, they're okay, they're alive. Like, I'm with them now. And then he passed the phone over. But he was like, this is what's happened. And we're going to have to be logistical and sort out insurance so they can get back to London.
Mm-hmm. And how many days were you in the Zanzibar hospital?
I would say from the attack to the point we got to Chelsea and Westminster Hospital was about 24, 26 hours.
How did you fly home with the injuries? Like, did you have any other treatment other than like water there? Or did, what did they do? Just cover you in dressings and fly you home?
So from the first hospital there, they ran out of saline. So from there, we went to a local hotel and stood under the shower for about 5 to 6 hours. And then Sam, who was a saint, arranged us to get on an aeroplane and fly over to the mainland of Tanzania. From there, we stayed in a hospital for, I don't know, 12 hours, whatever it was. And there I received painkillers, just pills and things.
So you were conscious the whole time?
Yeah, the whole time. Then we got an ambulance to get on the medical aeroplane home. And that was the first time I was given proper drugs and knocked out, essentially.
And in this interim, what about your eyesight?
My eyes were fine. I was just lucky I blinked at just the completely right time. I've had skin grafts on my eyelids, but I was just lucky in the sense that I blinked at the right time. Mm-hmm. So my eyesight wasn't affected, thank God.
Yeah, but I guess at that time you had no idea what the injuries were. Had you looked in the mirror in Zanzibar?
Yeah, I looked in the mirror. I saw myself most of the way through. So there was a mirror in the first bathroom and then I hadn't looked at myself up until... we got off the aeroplane at one stop and that's when I saw myself properly.
What was that like?
So swollen. And Kirsty, I remember I turned to her and she just said, like, stop looking. And I was like in a wheelchair at this point. So it was really hard for me to get up because my whole leg had been burnt.
Yeah.
It was so swollen, like completely 2 times the size of my normal face.
And when you were leaving Zanzibar, obviously it was all about you need to get back, you need to get medical treatment. Was there any discussion about where is this guy? Who is he? Are you going to go find him?
I think there was, but I wasn't in the discussions. It was more so with like Sam and, I don't know, governors and whoever works in Tanzania.
So the police didn't come to visit you in Zanzibar then?
No, they didn't. I think one policeman came to the second hospital. And then from there we wrote, what's it called?
Oh, like a witness statement.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So then you leave on the plane and then you land in what, Heathrow?
No, Northolt. And then there were 2 ambulances on the runway where we just got in straight away.
Wow.
And then straight to Chelsea Westminster.
Okay. Well, how are you feeling?
At this point, I had spoken to my mum quite a lot and I remember saying to her, just make sure it's a really good hospital because it's going to be bad. Mm-hmm. And my mum was just like, don't even worry about it. We'll sort out the treatment. Just we'll get you back home.
Did your mum know how severe it was at that point? Or do you think your mum didn't know the full picture? Or?
I don't think she really understood the full picture. I had sent her one picture because our insurance company wouldn't get us a medical aeroplane until they knew the extent of the damage. So I had to send a picture of my neck to say I couldn't go on a commercial flight.
Well, imagine the infection and stuff.
Right? I know, exactly. I couldn't, there was no way I could sit on a commercial flight, swap over, stay in Dubai for an hour. There was just no way it could happen. Also, I was like unconscious the whole aeroplane. There was just no way I could be conscious for that amount of time.
How did you feel on the admission to Chelsea?
I was so relieved. I thought, okay, now this could be sorted. I'm in the hands of professionals. Surely they'll figure it out.
Mm-hmm. And it was a long stay. It was 2 months, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Which, you know, like some people might think, oh, some people stay in hospital longer, but 2 months bedridden, like your whole normal life outside is all your friends' lives are just carrying on. And you're young and you're used to being independent.
Exactly. And it's not 2 months. I'm sure it's different for everyone, but it's not 2 months where you're just sitting at your bedside doing nothing. For me, I was having skin grafts and having skin removed, and you're in surgery every other day, and it's just the pain. And
it was 30% of your body, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly. So
it's a large burn.
I don't know, it's exhausting and horrible.
Can you tell, for people that haven't, you know, read your story before, can you explain what areas of your face and body were affected?
So the guy was on my right-hand side. So if you just think right-hand side of face, right arm, right chest area, right side of my stomach, right leg, thigh.
And then what was the treatment you had to have at Chelsea?
I've had the skin removed, and then I had donor skin put on my body. And then I had skin grafts. And then I had my ear removed. And then I had, that's more or less.
It's like such a list. You're like, I can't even remember.
I actually can't remember.
Yeah. And in this period, did you look in the mirror, take pictures, or did you not want to?
I was obsessed with taking pictures. Okay. I had my phone and I would always go on selfie mode, take pictures every day. And then in Chelsea and Westminster, there are no mirrors anywhere. So I would look whenever I had a shower or whenever there was a reflection, I would always look at night in the window. I would always look. I was obsessed with looking.
Do you think that was to do with control or?
Probably. Maybe. I think it was to do with control. And also I wanted to be aware of everything that was happening. I didn't want any secrets. I wanted to know the full extent of how bad the damage was.
Why was that?
I don't know. I felt that, like, if I knew everything that was wrong with me, then I could help fix it.
Okay, yeah.
And I didn't want to leave hospital and then be even more distraught when the damage was so much worse. I needed to prepare myself. But that's just how I am. I'm a bit of a fixer. I don't know how are you like?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with like trying, because I think basically it's a situation that's so out of your control. And the whole act of it happening to you is a sense of madness and out of control. So in the aftermath, you want to gain as much control as you can. But the reality is, in a medical journey, you're not in control.
No, not at all.
And you keep getting all this news from you know, this is happening now, or you've lost this, or this has gone wrong, or you can't have that. It's not possible. It'll never be the same again. So it's almost like a fake control for yourself to try and balance it out.
Yeah, you completely know? Fake.
Obviously, like a trauma like this can leave you on edge and with PTSD. Was that something that affected you? Did you have nightmares and flashbacks and things?
Yeah, I definitely suffered PTSD, 100%. I had nightmares and like anxiety. And I remember one surgery where I was in recovery for such a long time, and all I wanted to do was like rip out everything from my arm and just want to get up and walk out.
I get that, yeah.
Yeah. I think from then, like, something just clicked in my brain. So whenever I was in a situation where I felt like I couldn't leave, or I felt like I was trapped, or I don't know, I just couldn't leave a situation. That made me panic, and then I would get anxiety from that.
Yeah. And how did you, like, to present day now, I mean, obviously it was 6 years ago, how did you manage the anxiety? What did you do?
Therapy and cognitive therapy. CPD, is that what it's called?
CPD. Same therapy I had, CPD, yeah.
I was on pills for a little bit, but I stopped those.
And all this while that this was happening to you, how did the people around you deal with it? Because you've got family, you've got friends, you've got the medical professionals. You know, your friends are all really young at that time, you know.
Yeah, exactly. My friends had all started uni in that September, most of them anyway. Family were all great. In terms of family, friends and people around me who are older, didn't get it at all. They would just come over, see my mum for a cup of tea, and then say, oh, like, why don't you go out and like stop looking at the same four walls? And
did you not find that really frustrating?
So frustrating, because I was obviously, you want to go out and you want to not be in the situation. It's no one's fault that you're, well, it wasn't my fault that I was in the situation. And I felt that when people said that, I was being blamed for what happened, because I couldn't help myself, even though I was trying.
Were you scared to go out, or was it the medical reasons you couldn't go out?
Both. I didn't want to go out. I was scared and I didn't want to, so why would I?
Yeah. Did you have an anxiety about being attacked again in London?
Yeah, that was a recurring nightmare, was that I was going to be attacked again. I feel like I still have it sometimes, or I'll imagine being attacked again, things like that.
How do you cope now? Like, you know, we're so connected with all the news apps. Mm-hmm. And even if you don't have news apps on your phone, people like helpfully share links on Facebook and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And, you know, there was a while when the media were like, oh, acid attacks are on the rise, violent crimes on the rise in London. Mm-hmm. How does that make you feel when things like that get pushed your way and you hear those stories?
I think it's terrifying. I think that the news creates copycats. And I think that that scared me in the sense that I didn't want some sick people to get inspired by what they hear and mm-hmm. get inspiration from it. So that really freaked me out in a sense. In some ways, it's good in terms of raising awareness, but is it good to raise awareness of acid attacks? I'm not sure. I'm still not convinced.
So this, I mean, now you're 23.
Right? Yes.
So, I mean, from 18, how many years was your life on hold? Because recovery, all you do is recover. Mm. You can't work. You can't do normal stuff for a while, can you?
No, not at all. I don't think life ever gets normal. It just gets more normal. I mm-hmm. feel like it's not even normal now. Mm. I feel like even when when it is normal and I'm living normal day-to-day life and I'm at work and I'm having lunch with people from work and just doing things like that, I feel like it's still not normal yeah. because I've been attacked.
Yeah, of course.
And
yeah.
I can still feel where the scars are on my body. So obviously they're numb, but I know where they are. So mm-hmm. even if I'm like having a lovely day and having a good conversation, I can still think to myself for a split second, oh, you've got scars on that face.
Mm. How do you feel about your, like the scars, but like just your whole body and appearance in general?
I think it depends what day it is. I think that I try and be positive because like whether I'm positive or negative, I still have scars on my body, so I might as well try and be positive about them. Mm-hmm. But I think in reality, it's hard to always think that way as much as I want to.
Mm. Do you think there's any element in like our culture or media that makes it worse for you?
Yeah, definitely. I think that there's just so much pressure to look a certain way, and I'll never be ashamed of having scars. I'll never, if someone wants to ask me a question or looks at me, I'll never feel shame or guilt, but it's always a sense of that I wouldn't feel like pretty or good enough.
Mm. And have you had intrusive, rude questions or just uninvited comments?
I haven't had that many rude comments to my face. Mm. I've had lots of stares and I've had intrusive comments asking like, what happened to you? And
what do you say when people...
It depends what mood I'm in. If I'm in a good mood, maybe I'll explain. But if I'm not in the mood to talk or explain, I'll be like, oh, it's a long story. Mm. What do you think is the most annoying question?
God, I mean, basic stuff like what's happened to you. Mm. It's a very painful question. You know, it's a long-winded question. The worst scenario is when I'm with my child and people yeah. say that to me because, you know, I don't really want to say in front of a four-year-old, will somebody rape me and acid attack me?
Oh, no.
And they live in this country.
Yeah.
But people's own curiosity outweighs their moral stance of like, is this okay in front of a toddler?
Yeah.
And like for me, I think that comes from a gossipy, it's not a concerned question, it's a gossipy. Yeah.
To me, it's that when you are known by lots of people, I think that they feel that they're entitled to know everything about you and don't really care who's around you.
Were the people like, was it hard for you to do the rounds with friends and have to explain, or did someone on your behalf kind of explain to everyone?
I actually have no idea. I have no idea where it started, but my friends knew as soon as I landed in the UK.
Okay.
So whether that was one friend told one friend. Also, it was on the news. Yeah. I remember...
It was a big story in the news.
I had a few friends who found out from the news. Mm. And I think just people talk.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere. And no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
You may have heard of the podcast Juicy Scoop. Wondered what it is? Why aren't you listening? Well, I'm its host. Created it, been doing it for 7 years. I'm Heather McDonald of Juicy Scoop with Heather McDonald. Now, I could tell you why you should be listening to my show, but my listeners wanted to write the ad for me, and here are some of the things they said. Not your regular Juicy podcast. Catch up on all the juicy topics from Hollywood and pop culture to true crime and beyond. Heather McDonald's Juicy Scoop always has great guests, great laughs, and great gossip. It's a comedian's take on the hottest headlines. Juicy Scoop is the pop culture news you want to hear. No BS, no filter, no filler. Raw, real, and in the moment. Throw in the hilarity of amazing comedians that you'll instantly be obsessed with, a juicy crime story, and a dash of normal life in LA moments, and you've got yourself an amazing week of Juicy Scoop. Two episodes every week, every Tuesday and Thursday. It will never let you down.
And do you have, like, closure? Or because you didn't get any justice, is that right?
No, he was never found.
And was there attempts, like, was there a manhunt to find him? Like,
there was an identity parade, but I didn't go. Kirsty went to the identity parade. It was in Zanzibar.
How comes you didn't go?
Because I was having surgery and I didn't feel safe and there wasn't going to be good security and there was no glass screen in front of us and the attackers.
Mm-hmm.
She chose someone who she thought was the right person, but in her defense, I don't know if the right person was even there in the line.
Mm. So what happened to the person she chose?
Nothing.
Because it just wasn't enough evidence.
Yeah, it wasn't the right person and it wasn't the person they had in mind either.
So then did you just get communication that we have no evidence and we're closing the case?
Not, it's an open case, but it's a dead case essentially. So Scotland Yard came over many times and said, we'll still try and do everything we can if something else comes up, but at the moment there's not much else we can do.
And how did you feel about that outcome?
I kind of knew it was going to happen because we were going back and forth for a good year and a half to 2 years. And when it gets to the year point, you just think, okay, they would probably have found the guy by now. It's a tiny town.
Mm.
So someone knows probably. I think that everyone on the island probably knows who it was.
But they protect them.
Yeah, exactly.
And do you have your own theory about why it happened?
I think it's because we were white girls, young, vulnerable, and if it wasn't us, it was going to be two other girls.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't that many white people on the island, mm-hmm. and people talk, and maybe they saw us having fun a few nights, or I don't know, saw who we were, and in that sense, maybe they recognised us. We'd never had a conversation with them, but maybe they knew who we were.
Okay. So how did you make your closure? Because you didn't get a legal trial, you didn't get answers. Like, how did you make it okay in your head?
I don't know. Because it was in another country, I think that closure in terms of distancing myself away from the attacker was easier than if my attacker lived in London. Like, I think that would be a different story. But because they were on the other side of the world and please God stay there, that I think in terms of the attack made it easier for me to make recovery one dimension, attack another dimension.
Mm-hmm. So I don't want to use the word normal because, you know, to say your life's gone back to normal, you're rebuilding your life to the best you can.
Yeah.
When did you sort of like go back to regular stuff? You were having all your treatment and sort of 18, 19.
Yeah. I enrolled in university the year after, worked from home for the first few years, then finished my degree and applied for jobs as that was finishing.
Mm.
So last year.
Okay, so that, I mean, that's like, this is pretty amazing, right? You went to uni, you lived away from home?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're in Nottingham uni.
Exactly. I was lucky, I had friends who were there, and so I had a house to live in with a bunch of girls I knew, essentially.
Okay.
But in terms of new people, obviously, when you're out and meeting new people and everything.
Yeah, that's hard.
People talk, yeah.
Yeah. But do you think it was good for you to like go off and do your thing?
I think it was good for me, yes, but I also think that there were many times where I didn't want to be there and I don't know if it actually helped.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's the right advice.
Yeah, no. It's just the truth, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's just
exactly.
What happened.
Exactly.
So you left uni and you now work in property, is that right?
Exactly, I work in commercial property.
So what do you want, what's your kind of plan? What would you like to do?
I just want to work hard. I'm doing a master's at the same time.
So you haven't let this stop you and take you off the direction you wanted to go in?
No, I wouldn't let. I'm too much of a control freak. Definitely.
But maybe it's that resilience that got you through the initial aftermath of the attack.
Maybe. Or that it's just made it heightened.
like the way you're living your life now, the person you are, do you think it's pretty similar with that thing in between? Or do you think you're a different person because of what happened?
I think I'm different. I don't know what I would have been like otherwise, but I definitely think I'm like very observant, quite paranoid in terms of like who's around me, where I am. Am I safe here? When I'm on the tube looking around, I hate listening to music on the tube and people think I'm mad, but mm-hmm. I just like to be aware of everything I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I am definitely more resilient, I think.
And you said you do feel like a different person. So do you separate the two worlds of like you pre and you post? Like, do you feel like it's been two different people and two different lives?
Yeah, I really do. Do you?
Yeah, well, yeah. I compare it to like a bereavement. I feel like the person before is no longer here.
Yeah, I agree.
Which is like some negative, some positive, you know, it's just sort
it's
of
sad.
Like, do you live with sadness, do you think?
I don't... I have moments of sadness, definitely. I don't think I'm sad or a sad person, but there are definitely moments where it's a really sad situation.
Mm-hmm. Sad because you didn't deserve it, sad because...
Because no one deserves it, and there were so many moments of sadness over the recovery period that's just so unbearable. So it's just sad that it happened. And I think it's sad if I'm like looking in a mirror and I feel really ugly, like that's sad. And like, it's just small moments like that. Even if I put some makeup on, feel a bit better and still go out, it's still sadness, I think.
But there have been some amazing moments in terms of, so if anyone followed you on Instagram, what's your Instagram handle?
KTJG.
So they will see you are very proud and you are very truthful. You post pictures of yourself in a bikini showing your burns. Mm-hmm. You like Photoshop yourself. Mm-mm. Like you are honest and, mm-hmm. and I would say really confident online.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is really positive. I mean, tell us about the hashtag campaign.
So I only start here like talking really about what happened besides family and friends maybe last summer. Mm-hmm. So less than a year ago. And then from then I wrote an article and one of the titles was just not very nice. It was describing me as like horribly disfigured and some other things. And so from then I posted it on Instagram and then started a campaign called Setting the Standard. Essentially for people to post a picture of anything that they thought wasn't good enough, didn't fit into society or the media's ideal of normal, pretty, perfection, anything. And take a picture of something that they felt wasn't good enough and then tag all their friends to do the same. So there were people posting pictures, anything from no makeup to scars, cellulite, spots, anything.
That's brilliant. That's really, really good. And like in a world of Instagram where we see so many things that are toxic and mm-hmm. not positive, mm-hmm. like that's such a great thing to see on your feed. Like you must have felt a sense of achievement. Like,
yeah, I was really proud that I did it because also... I didn't start like a new page. All my followers, like were all my friends and family, they saw what I was doing. So I was like, I just had to own it.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Do you think that was good for you?
Yeah, definitely. I'm so happy that I did it.
I mean, amazing things have happened because you have, you know, been strong enough to talk about it. You've done mm-hmm. your campaign. You know, I've seen, I think you've written for Grazia, haven't you? Yeah. I mean, that's pretty good. You're like 23 and you've written in Grazia. Yeah. Like, that's pretty cool, right?
Yeah, I've done some good articles.
Yeah, and you can write really well. Like, mm-hmm. you're a really intelligent young woman. Like, you have done some things that, did you think you wouldn't be doing these things at this stage in your life?
Yeah, I've definitely, there are definitely things that I wouldn't have done otherwise. I like wouldn't have written any articles and the charities that I work with, I wouldn't have worked with any of them. So there are definitely aspects.
Yeah, they're big. They're more than just aspects. Yeah. They're massive things. Like, you're amazing. Like to think where you're at now, it's still so soon and you've come so far from when I first met you. And, you know, when we got back in touch about you doing the podcast, I was like, I wonder where you're at and how you're feeling. And it's like, it is really, really inspiring. Mm. Like for people listening who, you know, some people listening might be directly affected by burns. Some people might not at all, but might have similar emotional concerns and issues. Like, do you have any advice about, you know, what coping mechanisms you've used and how you've got to where you are and how they could do the same?
For me, the things that help me the most are writing things down, but like privately, mm-hmm. not showing anyone.
So like a private diary.
Diary entries, scrapbooks, but private. No one's like ever seen anything. Mm. I I'm such a hoarder. I saved every single card I ever had.
Mm.
I've got all my face masks. I've got
really.
Yeah, I kept everything. I kept all my loads of my pressure suits.
What was the reason?
I don't know. And I've been called weird for saving everything before, but I don't know. I have a box and I've just kept everything because I'm not ready to depart from it yet. So writing things down and saving everything helped me personally just to see the progress.
Mm.
What else helped me? Therapy.
Mm.
Surrounding yourself with good people and cutting out people who make you feel not good.
Did you do that then? Did you have a bit of a cull and get rid of...
Not like a cut off, but definitely slowly distance, see someone less if they're not making you feel good.
Mm-hmm.
Be a bit selfish with your time. Don't do things that you don't really want to do unless you have to do them.
And how do you feel about you present day? You know, are you in a good place? Do you feel stable?
Mm. Yeah, I think I'm pretty stable.
Mm.
I don't really know. I just take each day as it comes.
Yeah, which is another good piece of advice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because if you don't do that, then you're in a state of anxiety about the future. And
yeah, exactly. I think just be really aware of actually how you do feel. So if you're feeling sad, but you're trying to cover it with happiness, I think that just, I don't know, be a bit selfish and just don't go out that weekend if you're feeling low.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with being selfish because everyone benefits around you if you're in a better place
exactly.
because of it.
And you don't want to be worse off otherwise.
Mm.
What do you think helped you the most?
I
find it really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I think it's time. And when you meet anyone who's at the beginning, everyone's like, I just want to get better. When's it over? This isn't awful.
And
it's
a fast-forward life.
Yeah, and burn injuries, really slow recovery. Physically, but also mentally, you really have to accept looking permanently different.
Yeah.
And no one can change that for you. And you just have to get through that. And, you know, that time, that patience, I was not a patient person and I had to learn patience. But I agree with you that your life will never be the same again.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in a negative way, but I mean that in a factual way. How can you have a life-changing trauma?
Exactly.
And say you'll go back the same? You just won't.
And I think to say otherwise would be giving people false hope.
Yeah, and it's not always been a negative thing. I used to see it as a negative thing, but I don't now. I am me, and there's some things that are more difficult than others, but there's some things that aren't, and I have loads of things that make me really happy. I live with a permanent piece of sadness in me too.
Yeah.
I really do, but I think, why? How would I not, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't expect not to.
Exactly, so. I think that's a really healthy way of looking at it, I think. I think covering up is long-term damage.
Yeah, my ultimate feeling is what I've learned to realise at a young age that a lot of people don't young is life is so precious and health is so precious and anything can change in a few seconds. Ultimately, it's given me this sense of a respect for health, a respect for life. It's minimised how much I care about my appearance because I know it's a fragile thing that won't last anyway and it's not so important.
Mm-hmm.
So it's made my life better because I go out there and I don't second guess anything. I'm not scared of doing things. I'm not worried about rejection because I've had the worst anyway.
Yeah.
You know?
I think in some aspects similar, I'm more unapologetic about a lot of things. Mm. Probably if I have an opinion or there's something in life I want to do, I'll do it.
Yeah.
But in other ways, if I'm having a self-conscious day, I'll be completely the opposite.
But I think that's okay.
And
I think people that don't have any visible difference others have that too, you know, there's pressure on everybody, you know. So what about you for the future? I mean, obviously you're very hardworking. You came straight from work to this podcast.
I did. Oh God.
What's your kind of future dreams and hopes and ambitions?
I just want to enjoy my life.
Mm.
That's what I want to do. That's all I care about.
And obviously you saying that, that means you believe you can enjoy life after burns, after trauma.
Yeah. Well, I think that whether I like it or not, it's happened. So I might as well enjoy life with being burnt than not enjoy life with being burnt.
Mm.
That's just how I think. So I just want to enjoy my life and work hard and do whatever, just be happy. That's all I actually care about. Just want to laugh and be happy.
And you've done lots of things that required confidence, like going to work in a new company, going to live away at uni. So you obviously are a confident person in a time that your confidence took a major hit.
Yeah.
Anyone that's listening who's struggling to get the confidence to do new things, venture out, what advice would you give them?
I think, I don't know if this is good advice. I think if you want to feel confident, a good thing to do is just fake it.
Mm-hmm.
And then that might lead to other good things. You might meet someone, you'll be like, okay, this made me feel more confident.
Yeah.
Meeting someone at a party when like, you didn't want to go because you didn't feel confident. So mm-hmm. I think fake it and it will lead to other good things. And then the more you fake it, the more you'll be confident and believe it.
Yeah, I think you're right. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I mean, even though we've met many times before, we've never talked like this, you know. Mm. So it's been really interesting to hear about your story and like your present day now. And I really appreciate you sharing it because I know like some of it might not be easy to talk about as well. So, yeah, thank you very much for sharing those
Thanks
parts.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you have been an extraordinary person.
Thanks for listening to Katie Piper's Extraordinary People. If you haven't already, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this, please help us spread the word. Rate and review the show where you got this, or share on socials.